Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The U.S. Department of Education recently granted $11.5 million to help Columbus State Community College help some Central Ohio youngsters prepare for college. The grant targets youth from poorer zip codes and reflects the fact that, despite overall improvement in college readiness, financially disadvantaged students tend to need more remedial college coursework. The question is, what can that money buy and will it be enough? Joining us now is the director of the Walter E. Dennis Learning Center at Ohio State University, Chris Walters. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Also, the Associate Vice Chancellor for P through 16 Initiatives at the Ohio Department of Higher Education, Rebecca Watts. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And from the Columbus State Community College, where she is Executive Director of College Transitions, Kelly Hogan. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Kelly Hogan, what's the competition like for grant funds aimed at low-income students who need help with college coursework? What's the demand for it?
Well, Columbus State, I think, is very excited to have received this grant because the I-3 grant is a unique one, and Columbus State is unique in that we are the only community college who was selected. It was a very competitive grant, and so we're excited that with in collaboration with seven area district partners, we're going to have the opportunity to, over the next 5 years, effect a great difference, we believe, with college readiness and college coursework for these young people.
So there's a big demand for it. There's a growing recognition that this is a niche that needs to be dealt with. Rebecca?
Absolutely. We know that the remediation rates in Ohio, while they are improving, there is still a set of students that as they leave secondary and go to post-secondary, they are going to need some extra help. And the root causes of that vary by student, but we know that it is an ongoing need.
Chris Walters, how do you target those kids, especially in high school?
The students that come to us at the Dennis Center sort of are volunteers. So these are the students that have been admitted to OSU. They come, they experience the OSU atmosphere, and then they realize that they're struggling in particular areas. So time management, procrastination, study strategies, a whole variety of things. So from my perspective, it's sort of a volunteer thing. But the kinds of activities that we engage in with them, the workshops, the tutoring, or the coaching that we call, as we call it, can certainly be pushed down into the high school. And there's aspects of it at the high school. But it's not exactly content area tutoring. And so sometimes students are resistant to the idea that they need to learn study skills. These are typically, especially at OSU, very bright students. Mm-hmm. And so they're not necessarily always doing poorly in high school. They get by in high school without necessarily being good time managers or having extraordinary study skills. They can get through a high school class just by being bright. So it's not always easy.
You know, Kelly Hogan, you said you have six or seven partners that you're working with in the region?
Well, that's with respect to this grant. When you look at our partnerships, just in terms of working with high schools, we have students from over 100 high schools in Ohio who are doing some type of college coursework, even while they're still in high school with us. And we're actually out in maybe 50 district or 50 schools now doing dual enrollment. I think one of the most exciting things about this grant is we're able to work even earlier with these students around support measures that will help them become more college ready. So I think the kinds of things that you were just talking about, if we can start working with
like time management, those kind of things.
Yes, time management. So we have advisors, college advisors, who actually go out into some of these high schools to work with students early and parents and families to help help them understand exactly what college ready means, what being a college student means. So we're looking at content, of course, but we're also looking about all of the other things. So you mentioned time management. That's a great one. And then just college expectations. There's a big difference between what you do in high school and what you do in college and some of those expectations. So the earlier we can talk about those things and help students and their families understand the differences, the better chance I think the students will have of being successful even that very first semester.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about college readiness today, what it takes to prepare for it in
high school and what is out there for you if once you get to college is when you realize you're not as ready as you thought you were. What has changed in the equation of higher education and the preparation for it, K through 12? Is it what the expectations are at higher education, what we expect them to know? Or is something changed on the other side of the equation? Rebecca Watts, I'm trying to figure out where the shift has occurred or if it's always been there.
The shift, well, so let's back up just a little bit. And let's, you know, we talk about there's great angst over the remediation rates that we've seen in the last couple decades, mm-hmm. maybe the last three or four decades. You have to back up historically and look at the function of the college and university in society. And we, if you really back up, it was the GI Bill after World War II that really opened access to our institutions. And colleges and universities became really career preparatory places. Even our liberal arts universities are preparing folks for the workforce, as opposed to kind of the ivory tower model where it was where you went and became a learned man. And I use that term intentionally. We have really opened access to our institutions. So we have people from all walks of life now matriculating to post-secondary education for purposes of improving their lives and their long-term success for their families. So a lot changed. The GI Bill, and then the access, the advent of the community college in the 1960s. So really post-secondary education changed, and there are much, much higher rates of high school graduates seeking post-secondary education than there ever were before. Well, one of the things that that means is that the post-secondary setting has to change because its function and its purpose has changed. It also means that when we look at our high schools, they need to have an understanding of what the expectations are for students. That dialogue has finally started to happen. So we now have K-12 teachers visiting post-secondary classrooms and seeing some surprises. They haven't sat in a freshman lit course since they were in a freshman lit course themselves. By the same token, college faculty and university faculty are going back and visiting high school classrooms because it's been even longer since they themselves sat in a high school classroom. And so they are, you know, kind of growing and strengthening their understanding of the current settings, which are certainly different than they were when we all experienced them, and looking at alignment so that we have, in Ohio now, we have a uniform statewide remediation-free standard as it relates to academic content preparation.
Right.
That was work that was legislated back in 2012. The law said the public college and university presidents in Ohio shall come together and set a bright line for what it means to be college ready, also defined as remediation free in this state. So that work happened in 2012. And I will tell you that prior to that work, there was wide variance across the state in what was triggering student placement into remedial courses on the basis of large-scale standardized assessments for academic content knowledge. So we got that bright line set back in 2012. And that helped. But it can't just be that. As you've heard Kelly and Chris talk about today, it's beyond what do you know in the content area. It's
how
it's
well
multiple,
you take tests.
That's right. It's multiple measures. It's your time management. It's your ability to stick with something. It's discipline. It's all of those things. And so that work has to be approached from all angles, and all parties have to be at the table.
And, you know, we were talking before we went on the air, Chris Walters, you know, a lot of what you're dealing with are these soft skills, the ability to get up in the morning, set an alarm, address the alarm, feed yourself, clothe yourself, all this kind of stuff. We've talked about this on the show before, that a lot of kids are very handicapped in these issues because someone did it all for them.
Yeah, I think that's true to an extent. I think that, you know, the struggle in high school for many kids is to get good grades and to score.
That's their job.
Right. And it's not necessarily, you know, from a parent's perspective, I do as much as I can to help that happen. And I don't necessarily see my job as to making sure that the time management gets done or that there's no procrastination. Or another popular topic at the Dennis Center is just motivation, right? So we deal with a lot of students who come to college and they're in college because it's expected of them. It's the next logical step for their academic career. But if you start talking to them about what their goals are and sort of matching a realization of what their personal goals really are and the importance of doing well in classes, there can be a disconnect, right? That they need to, I think, experience this idea that, okay, I really need to accept that my goal is to be successful in college and get ready for this career and all that entails. And I need to own this and be devoted to it. And that's not always this what you find when freshmen get there their first August, right? They're coming to OSU because this is Ohio State University, and it's the culmination of a successful career rather than the start of one. And I think we help them at times make that shift.
And achieving things like motivation isn't something you do in an online course over the summer.
For some
people, it can.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily an optimal situation. I think that, you know, we do a lot of work with groups and, you know, in classes and workshops where we get people talking about it. And I think it helps to be sharing. So to the extent that you can achieve those kinds of goals with some sort of online situation, it might be possible. But there's a lot of, as you were saying, soft skills or motivational beliefs and attitudes that kids have. People talk about grit. They talk about mindset. There's sort of a whole host of different ways of thinking about it. But it comes down to really the ability to stick with things and persist when college gets tough. And so even for the best students, college gets tough. It may not happen for some students until their third year or their fourth year, perhaps, but it eventually gets tough. And not just tough in terms of the content that they're asked to learn, but the amount of demands they're asked to juggle, the social demands, you know, all of the different things that come to sort of fruition as they get to campus. You know, time management doesn't stop being a concern in college. You know, time management is a big issue for people in the workplace. And so it's not that these students aren't capable learners or capable at the content. It's just a skill that many of us continue to struggle with throughout our lives.
We are talking about college readiness today, what it takes, what government organizations are doing to help us achieve that for our children and our children's children going forward. Now that the conversation has finally started, college has changed a lot back after the World War II and the GI Bill, when more and more and more and different kinds of people were going to college. Again, in the 60s, when the community colleges, junior colleges, as they were referred to back then, came online. If you have a question or comment, want to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Check out our Facebook page and post a question or a comment there. If you have a kid in college right now and are worried about their college readiness, this is a great time to ask your questions. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about what makes a student college ready. Is it just a matter of money, their school district, their peers, or teachers? Still with us is the Associate Vice Chancellor for Peace Through 16 Initiatives at the Ohio Department of Higher Education, Rebecca Watts. Thanks again for joining us, Rebecca.
My pleasure.
And Executive Director of College Transitions at Columbus State Community College, Kelly Hogan. Thanks again, Kelly.
Thank you.
And Director of the Walter E. Dennis Learning Center at Ohio State University, Chris Walters. Welcome once again.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. Kelly Hogan, College Transitions, that department at Columbus State Community College, you're the first director, right?
It is a newly created position, only been around a couple years now. And so my work has a lot to do with all of the partnerships we have with the many high schools in Central Ohio. So this originally came out of our work in the area of remediation, which has been my specialty over the last 20 years, teaching developmental mathematics at Columbus State Community College. We started doing some things at Columbus State to help accelerate students through remedial mathematics, because math has always been one of the greatest challenges for students who come to college in terms of readiness, even more so in many cases than the writing and reading. So we worked very hard to come up with an acceleration strategy and found it to be very successful for students to move through the material more quickly and still be successful at that next level. And so a few years back, we started working with area high schools to implement this same strategy in those high schools so that students had the opportunity to work through and fill in those gaps in mathematics and then find themselves more college ready when they did graduate from high school. So it essentially shortened or removed the need for math remediation after they graduated from high school.
One of the issues about remediation is those credits don't go toward your degree, right?
You're right.
So it costs more money if you have to wait until college to address it, and it takes more time.
Yes, and money is one thing, most definitely. Time is another. And the longer a student has to go through remedial classes, the lesser that chance. I mean, you lose sight of that ultimate goal because you feel like you're spinning your wheels. It's a real struggle. So the more that we can do in the college to help students be successful more quickly and get into the college classes, which are usually the classes they're more interested in.
Yeah.
Not too many folks want to come to college to just take math. That's not necessarily their goal. They're trying to get into a specific career field in which they need math. So we want to try to get them to those goals that they have and where they're excited to be in those classes.
So give me an example of some way that you improve the process so that they get through faster and better prepared
for
remediation.
Sure. We created a series of modules that allowed students to, in a single semester, get through multiple classes. And we attached a certain number of credit hours to this class that allowed them to do it, spending not only just that single semester getting through one, two, three, or four classes, depending on their level of motivation and how much time and energy they put into it, but it also... It meant less time and less money because they could do it in the credit hours of a single semester. So they were able to advance.
And they could just go at their own speed then.
Yes. They were in what we consider kind of a facilitated computer lab where the instructor worked with them almost on a one-on-one basis. So everybody was working at their own pace, and we had pacing guides, calendars to make sure they were meeting whatever their goal was. So they may be starting in a different place because there are all different levels of placement in remedial math, but they could accelerate and they could plan out what they needed to do in that semester to get through the number of courses they needed to be college ready or into the next class that counted the subsequent semester. Oh.
Yeah, a little bit of self-determination there that's sort of hidden in that whole process.
Absolutely.
Right.
If they're motivated and they're willing to put in the time, a lot of time with that instructor in the classroom. And the key about this was you were doing math. You weren't watching someone do math. You were doing it yourself.
Uh-huh.
And so you were getting better and more practiced with every minute you were in that classroom.
It kind of makes me wonder if the whole approach to math, because that is a bugaboo. It has been for, forever. There's a lot of journalism majors out there. Not me, but who went into it because it was one of the few majors that didn't require math. So this has been going on for a really long time. What do we know about how we're teaching math and how can that be improved? Because that is perennially a problem.
So
Rebecca?
There is a statewide Ohio Mathematics Initiative that's going on across our public colleges and universities. And it hits at the heart of what you just talked about. We historically, this is kind of backing up to talking about the model that we have for post-secondary. Historically, it was that college algebra was the gateway mathematics course, didn't matter what your major was.
Mm-hmm.
We know that that doesn't necessarily serve all academic majors very well. So over the past 2.5, now almost 3 years in Ohio, mathematics faculty have been coming together to define new gateway courses that meet the needs of, okay, you gave the example of journalism major. You need stats.
Yes.
You need advanced
Absolutely.
Stats. You need to understand statistics,
sort of a
right?
Joke, but
yes.
Yeah.
Right. No, I know. But so
we need
so,
to do percentages.
You do. So and you need to be able to interpret data
mm-hmm.
for your listeners. And if you are a dance major, what mathematical skills do you need? It's probably not necessarily what's embedded in the concepts of college algebra. If you are a sociology major, it's probably more stats than it is algebraic functions. So there has been an expansion of the gateway courses for mathematics, and there also is a look at co-requisite strategies, somewhat one of the models Kelly described is a little bit of a co-requisite strategy, except that some institutions now are taking those modules, and for students that are not testing out college ready on the standardized assessment, they are being enrolled in the credit-bearing course, but doing this co-requisite developmental strategy at the same time so that they don't so much feel like they're spinning their wheels, but they're getting the extra help they need in some ways, like what Chris does with folks.
Right. And that, what Kelly was talking about was reminding me of this, the self-regulatory processes that you commented on here, that, you know, if you put students in that kind of environment where you're going to have self-pacing and sort of self-control, then you need to ensure that those students have some skills at doing that, right?
Yeah,
so setting a goal, being motivated for that goal, working towards that goal, feeling confident that they can reach that goal if they put in a sufficient effort. And those aren't always there as well. So, you know, if you don't want to end up with those kinds of instructional settings and have students who aren't prepared for them or aren't comfortable in those settings. And so sometimes that can take, for lack of a better word, remediation in these sort of self-regulatory skills that we at the Dennis Center try to help college students with.
Agreed. And I think also the faculty member who you have in that classroom is really critical to the success. That faculty member has to be comfortable with this new approach to learning and acceleration. And so the more that you can have good training and collaboration among the faculty to make this a success is key. You know, I mean, I've talked about math. We've also tried some strategies with English. So folks who place just below college level in writing have the opportunity to take a college level class that has that extra support built in with an extra hour that includes an additional tutor in that room to work on the writing skills. So again, that means you don't have to spend a semester in developmental writing before going on to your college English class. It's built in to that. So there are many ways to approach remediation in college, and it's by discipline, and there are many best practices out there if you're researching that across the nation. And so it's important that we're all on top of that now.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Deborah in Columbus, you're on the air. You're an educator.
Yes, I am an educator at a local college, and I agree completely with what they're saying about the student needed to being motivated, and the pacing is a really great idea. And we are experiencing the exact same thing with some of the fundamentals of communication and mathematics and computer technology. While students are able to navigate a cell phone for using some of the software programs, Word, Excel, some of those things, they're really challenged. And we're finding it even in the younger students that are coming out of high school just a couple years. So I think that maybe the high school curriculum needs to be looked at a little bit more statewide to get them – help them really get up to those fundamentals of basics. We do offer remedial classes, you know, initially starting out before we put them in anything more advanced. But I really do think that this comes back to the high school level as far as what are we really gearing our education come. And, of course, that does vary by district and their resources available.
Right, right. Thanks a lot, Deborah, for your call.
Thank you.
This is an important point, I think, that the colleges and the high schools, the faculty and the staff administrators, continue to have conversations around the expectations and the plans from both sides, because we continue to learn from each other what's happening in the college and the high school world. And the more that we can talk and understand what each entity is doing, the better we'll serve the students. I know we have faculty now who'll be meeting with faculty from the high schools to talk about our new math placement test. And we're doing some pilots with several districts who have an interest this spring in trying this. It has a remedial tool built in to make sure that students are testing at the appropriate level. And so the more we can converse and understand the challenges from both sides, I think the better we'll work together and serve students.
You know, it's kind of interesting that disconnect that existed for so long between higher ed and secondary or, high school. But I think that the disconnect extends to elementary, to middle school and middle school to high school. They don't necessarily know what they're doing at the high school level, what they're doing at the junior high level or the middle school level to prepare them for high school. There's the same sort of discussions, right, Rebecca, going on at every level.
Absolutely. It's those transition points.
It's logical to me.
Yes, right. Well, except for now when we talk about post-secondary, how much is post-secondary? How much are colleges and universities engaged with business and industry?
Right.
Because that conversation that needs to happen. So the caller talked about the fact that she is seeing students come in who are tech savvy because they can use a smartphone, but the kinds of office applications that you might expect for particular majors and certainly business and industry would expect, they haven't had much experience with that. So that really is all kind of reliant on the tools that, students need for success at every level for the next step of success. And those conversations have to be intentional. Mm-hmm. And I would assert they can't be built on the commitment of a champion. It has to be in somebody's job description. So in the elementary,
the vagaries of who might be in that job at a certain point.
And we see that. So Kelly's a champion at her institution right now. Chris is a champion at his institution. And what are we going to do when they move into a new position or a different position? Is it codified in a position description, a commitment from the institution that ongoing dialogue with secondary schools and with business and industry are part of that job?
Yeah, I don't know if I would call myself a champion, but I think that the Dennis Center is an example of what you're talking about, because the Dennis Center was founded based on an endowment from the Dennis family, right? And so this is not something that OSU necessarily wanted to invest in at the beginning. Huh. They certainly provide a lot of funding for it now through, you know, instructional costs and things like that. So it's sort of a joint operation now. But it was started because some family said, hey, this is a need that is present at OSU, and we have the resources to sort of show that it can be successful. And I think it has been.
Jim in Grandview, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yes. My son is 18. He's currently technically a high school senior. He is autistic, high functioning. And we have seen what you've been talking about dating back, you know, at each level of school. It's kind of a smorgasbord of what you get, even in a very, very good district.
Mm-hmm.
And when he did reach high school, the district agreed to send him to a school specifically for people with autism to help the learning skills. As it is, he's going to max out to age 21 or 22 before he actually graduates. We're hoping that college is down the road there. But right now what he's doing is learning many of the time management skills, the self-regulation skills. Learning is not a problem for him. Beating back and taking a test is a major hurdle. He simply his mind doesn't work that way. He doesn't understand that. And so I'm hoping that something, the programs you've been talking about, can be there when he does reach college to support him at that point, especially locally.
Yeah, no, Jim, it's a really, really great point, considering the number of people being diagnosed is on the spectrum now. You know, are you encountering these sorts of issues now, Kelly?
Absolutely. We have an autistic population. We have a very diverse population at Columbus State. You know, we have about 25,000 students, and so we're talking all types of.
I think I've interviewed an autistic student.
Have you?
At Columbus State, yeah.
So our Office of Disability Services excels at helping students. We also have clubs and organizations that help students. Because we're talking about a lot of different social and emotional aspects to learning, as well as the learning of the academic content itself. So, you know, I think one of the most important things is that when students come to college, they have those time management skills, but they also know to ask for what it is that they need. So if they've had some special learning plan in high school, they need to share that with the college so that the college can support them in their learning in any way possible. It's possible that perhaps a student's on an IEP
in
high
school. Individual education plan.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. If that student's on an IEP in high school. They're receiving certain services to be successful. When a student comes to college and they bring that documentation with them, it is again assessed, and it is it's used to determine what the services will be in college. What some folks don't realize is that the services provided in college may be different from what was provided in high school. But until that initial exchange takes place, nothing's going to happen to help support that service, that student, outside of the regular services of the college. So it's important for them to express early what they need.
And Rebecca Watts, you were saying that there's nothing to compel a student to do that. It's not like it comes along with their record from high school.
That's
private.
That's correct. That record cannot transfer by law. And so it really is incumbent on families and students to understand that they must self-declare and say, this is a need I have.
Whether it's ADD, ADHD, autism.
Whatever it is. Whatever, if it's a mobility, if it's a food, if it's if it's a food allergy, they just need to be able to self-declare that. But we also know that there is a reluctance to self-declare, especially to those disabilities that are not really automatically apparent when you encounter a person. And they and students sometimes say, you know, I'm not going to take extra help. I'm not going to need any extra help. And then we see them hit that crisis point as it nears the end of their first academic term. And really at that point, that term is almost lost to them, because it takes a while to get those services in place, to establish the routine for that, the protocols for that. And it's distressing for the student. It's distressing for their family. And again, in post-secondary, because of privacy laws, information, depending on what the student allows to be released to family members, sometimes they won't sign that FERPA release. And so then it really, you can't, the officials at the institution can't even share information with family members. So there's a navigating post-secondary and this need to self-declare and the privacy laws that surround educational records. Parents, families, students need to be aware of all of those requirements and what impact that can have on student success.
And by the way, when Jim talked about maxing out to 21, that's what the state already offers somebody with a disability, certain disabilities. I don't know.
In K-12, if it depends on the IEP, but you can pursue your secondary education through the age of 21.
Right, right. Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Really appreciate that. If anyone else has a question or comment, we've got some calls waiting now, but there's certainly time for more. 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. There is good news for Ohio. The number of college remediation classes needed is decreasing. Today, we're dissecting why that is and what still needs to be improved to help students take on a college-level workload. Still with us to discuss that is Associate Vice Chancellor for P-16 Initiatives at the Ohio Department of Higher Education, Rebecca Watts, and the Executive Director of College Transitions at Columbus State Community College, Kelly Hogan, and also Director of the Walter E. Dennis Learning Center at Ohio State, Chris Walters. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Is there any benefit to doing a better job of sussing out who's suited for college in the first place and understanding what their motivations are early on? It seems like the high schools want to be known as one where 98% of their students move on to college. Is that necessarily a badge of honor, or is it maybe a sign that they're not doing a really good job at figuring out what kids need to transition into adulthood?
Post-secondary education is a means to an end. So the old term suited for college. Well, do you need college for what your long-term goals are? And that's a tough thing. I mean, you are right. If we could help students at the youngest age possible figure out what their long-term goals are and what skills, knowledge, and tools in their toolkit they need for that long-term success, we'd get them in that pathway. But the problem is when you're 16 and 17, do you know? So it's challenging for high schools to counsel and advise and work with each individual student to say, do you know your long-term goal? Look at how many undeclared majors we have when they get to college.
Is
they still don't know.
Is that
know.
Number increasing or not? Is it about the same as it always was? Or
I don't know.
Yeah.
I would say many of our students do declare a major. They do that in terms of financial aid, for one thing. But they also change their majors a lot. Very few of us who went off to college chose a major and stuck with it. I think it's very common practice to change your mind. You're young. Who knows what you want to be? Some of us are still trying to decide what we want to be when we grow up, right?
Right. Well, you could change. You know, that is the thing. Except in college, it's very expensive when you change. Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ann.
Go ahead.
A long time listener.
Thanks.
I'm an education researcher at The Ohio State University, and I teach a lot of physics courses. And if I could reach back to something that your guests were talking about 5 minutes ago, uh-huh. They were talking about changing things from prerequisites to co-requisites. And it's been my experience that when you do that, it really affects the depth of understanding that you can get in the subsequent courses, the courses that used to have prerequisites, where you can't delve into the same depth of material that you used to be able to now that certain math courses are co-requisites, for example. I was wondering if your guests could comment on how they handled that, how they've overcome that.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Chris. Good question.
So just to kind of put a fine point on the co-requisite strategies that we were talking about before, it is delivering remedial support in a co-requisite model. It is not shifting prerequisite courses to co-requisite courses. So I think
there's still
to put a fine point
a
on it, right. Yeah,
yes.
Sequencing of courses is an important thing. And so I wouldn't want the caller to think that we were advocating that you shouldn't have prerequisite courses for any particular thing. It is the co-requisite approach to delivering remedial support for those gateway courses coming in at the kind of that first level when you come into college.
Freshman
so,
English.
That's right. That's
okay.
Right. Correct.
So and a co-requisite for freshman English would be maybe an online module of grammar.
It could be that. It could be that as a co-requisite, that student needs to go to the writing lab.
Correct.
And do a set number of activities and projects. It could be co-requisite could be a peer tutor. Co-requisite could be that section meets for – it's a 3-credit-hour credit-bearing course toward graduation. And then there are 2 additional co-requisite hours for a subset of students in that course that's a developmental – simultaneous delivery, and they go more hours a week.
Just figuring all this stuff out. I mean, maybe Chris Wolters, you can address this. And by the way, Chris in Columbus, thanks for that call. It was a great question. But just figuring all this out takes a lot of time, what a student needs and whether they need a co-requisite or a prerequisite. And then I think you mentioned, Rebecca, that, wow, I mean, you just don't have enough time or people to deal with all the individuals in a high school to help them get prepared for whatever it is that they want to do. Are we not investing enough in those kinds of people like you, like all of you?
Well, I would say at Ohio State that there's, you know, a large population of academic advisors that students have access to.
What if we had more of those at the high school level?
Well, I know that high school is a busy place, and you know, we're sort of touching on the edge of resources and economic issues, we're sort of bumping into it in different places here. And I would say that that's an economic issue. And, you know, from the perspective of a parent, I know with a child in high school that the counselor isn't necessarily interested in meeting with students that are getting A's and B's in school all day, you know, because they have to spend their time on talking to students who have a more nuanced problem about what courses to take, when to take them, and how to take them, and that sort of thing. And so, you know, I guess I would say you have to be careful about putting people into these champion roles where you're going to add additional duties and additional responsibilities without adding the additional resources,
right?
So
the deployment of a school counselor in a district is very much a local decision. That's at the local discretion of the local school district. With that said, in the last set of legislation that came through in the budget bill, there are now statewide school counselor standards against which school counselors must be evaluated. And one of the catalysts for that legislation was that counselors were being pulled off. Instead of advising students, they were being assessment coordinators.
Yeah.
They were being schedulers. They were being – in some schools, they were being used almost as an assistant principal. And so the emphasis on getting them focused on the advising piece of this, and you make a good point, Chris, they also are the people in the building responsible for psychosocial counseling. Hmm. So students in crisis take that time as well. So it's true that the counselor, the advisor in the high school is probably under-resourced at this point, but the scope of services that they are called upon to provide for students is so broad. It's a tough challenge.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is. And I think, you know, we started this conversation talking about the I-3 grant that Columbus State has recently gained. You know, in that grant, we now have the opportunity to employ advisors who will be going out to these districts. So our advisors who we can employ through this grant can go out and work with the high school counselors and support those high school counselors because their job is immense. They work their ratio of counselor to student has to be exhausting. And there's a lot happening in those high schools and there's a lot of need. So the more that the college can help support the work and the understanding, I think that'll be very beneficial.
I think the other thing that sort of comes into play here, too, is that in many situations, there's sort of responsibilities thrust on the parents. And the assumption is the parents can help students sort of navigate these things. But the reason that first-generation students at Ohio State are so of interest is because they don't necessarily have parents that have the background that would allow them to sort of provide that navigator role. Mm-hmm. And it may not be that much different in high school, where you can assume that a parent knows what to do when they sit down and schedule courses with a kid about, you know, whether they should be taking this math course or this math. They may not know that. And so you now have to bring in parents and help them understand the system. And so that they can be a good advisor to their students or their children.
Liz in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Hi, Liz.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My mind's just going crazy with all the things. I am a retired teacher. I taught 27 years, clear up through college. Foreign language was my area. And what I see is going back in as a retired teacher and doing substitute teaching, that there are so many problems I see with just basically kids and their cell phones. They are so attached to those phones, you can barely get them to focus on what the lesson is. It's a huge problem, and no one's brought that up today. And another sideline, there are a group of us that want to get together as retired teachers, go into the schools, substitute, collect information to see how we can improve the whole situation in the learning process. And the third thing I wanted to throw in is that there's so many schools. Like, I lived in Spain for a while, and I lived in Mexico, and I watched how they transitioned the kids from what we call high school into the college. Like, they have a preparatory 2 years before they even go. And it's kind of like our Columbus State situation, but it's done in a lot different way. So there's so much information that we retired teachers have that could contribute, and we don't know how to do it. So you can take whatever that I just said and come up with something.
We'll come up with something, Liz.
I'm
that's
over.
Okay. That's okay. All right. First of all, technology and the phones. I mean,
Let me comment on that. So,
yeah.
So I agree with the listener that phones can be a distraction. And so, you know, now you have students who have to sort of learn at a younger level how to master having a distraction within arm's reach. But it's also been my experience that teachers are transforming the way they understand phones and the way that they use phones, so that before it was a distraction because it was sitting there, and if the kid was using it, they were using it sort of illicitly to check social media or any of those sorts of things. But now teachers are learning to use phones because phones aren't going away. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't take my phone away, right? And so teachers are learning that this is a tool that they can incorporate into the instruction and have students use in an effective way. That doesn't mean that it can't still be a distraction.
How? Give me an example.
Well, if you need students to, you know, search information, if you're doing, for example, learning about ancient Rome, and you want students to get information about the Parthenon or what this is, you can ask students to get on their phones and search the web for information and come up with ideas that are there right away for discussion, much like a student would be able to do if they're sitting around with their friends. And in fact, you're teaching them that if you want knowledge, here it is at your fingertips, and here's how you can get it and use it in educated ways. So I don't think technology is going away. And in fact, I would argue that workplaces want people who are sophisticated with technology, the right kinds of technology and in the right ways. But, you know, if we were to say take all technology out of high schools, we would be having a conversation about how students aren't getting prepared and how to use technology.
Because it's going to be there whether,
right.
whether we
And it's
going
to be important to whatever career they end up in.
What about the idea of master teachers? I guess that's kind of what I think about when I think about these experienced former teachers, retired teachers who are out substituting, and are we using all of those resources as effectively as we could? Rebecca?
We probably are not leveraging their skills, their knowledge, their expertise, and their experience to the degree that we can. The challenge here becomes, how formalized do you make that process? Is it something where you have the retired master teacher from a particular district reach out to colleagues, and then there has to be an openness with that school district that they would have them be an advisory council, or they would keep them engaged in some way. So in some ways, it's a district-by-district piece. I'll talk a little bit about this piece, which we've not really touched on today, and that is leveraging their skills and knowledge as a part of the professional pipeline of the new teachers that are coming in. So those master teachers would be a great asset to an educator preparation program in that we need those field supervisors, we need those mentors, we need those people that are out there with our new professionals in the field and helping them make their way in the profession, get started successfully in the profession, and really grab that expertise and apply it in their novice stage of their profession.
Let's see. Email from Edith. For years, I have said there should be a mandatory 2-year layoff in between high school and college. I don't care what you do during that time. Laze around on your couch as a potato, join the Peace Corps, Army, etc., tour the world. Learn some responsibility on your own time. There is a growing trend for taking a year off.
Gap year.
Some colleges and universities are better at taking advantage of that option than others. But is Edith off in left field, or is there maybe a maturity issue here?
I would say there's a maturity issue here. I mean, I think gap years are something that is becoming more popular, I believe, or more common. But it's something that I think is on a case-by-case basis, right? There are some students who don't need a gap year to be responsible college students and to sort of advance. And you know, there are others that benefit from those kinds of situations. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you can sort of, like other sort of absolutes, mandatorily say you need 2 years off.
Right. Right.
Maybe we could do that sort of at middle age too.
But yeah. maybe it's not that everybody needs to take 2 years off, but maybe that it is kind of changing the mindset so that it's okay if you take 2 years off. And it's sort of like the stigma piece. And I think maybe there are some parents that would have a hard time recognizing that maybe that's what their child needs, their student needs, is to take a couple of years, kind of sort this all out, get out in the workforce, get some experience there, and then maybe be more directed when you come back in.
Well, as I predicted, we only scratched the surface. There's lots more to talk about. My thanks to you all for joining me today. Chris Wolters, director of the Walter E. Dennis Learning Center at OSU, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Kelly Hogan, Executive Director of the College Transitions at Columbus State Community College.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And Rebecca Watts, Associate Vice Chancellor for P-16 Initiatives. representatives at the Ohio Department of Higher Education. Thank you.
Appreciate the conversation. Thank you.
Thanks to all the listeners. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.